Well, here is a subject that we will return to again and again and again for the foreseeable future. The pro-choice stance of the Democratic Party, is it eroding? Are some Democrats actually getting it that in order to succeed in politics in at least America today, they might have to mitigate their stand, their hard stance, their hard-edged stance in the pro-choice position? We're going to talk about that in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Back after a week's vacation, we were on a cruise. And just for those of you who are worried that I might be getting paid too much, no, I'm not getting paid too much. This was paid for by a benefactor in the family. My mother-in-law, in fact, hooked all 21 of us. I can't remember how many of us it was. She's loaded. Wilkin isn't. So she took us down to the Caribbean for a cruise, and it was very nice. I'm going to be talking a little bit about the cruise ship atmosphere, what was going on there. And I'm not talking about the drinking, the partying, and the people running around scantily clad. Everybody knows about that. I'm going to talk about its relationship to the church growth movement, of all things, a little bit later in the program today. So I'm back from vacation. I want to thank Mark Sill for sitting in Thursday last week. I heard he did an excellent job. I was going to try and log on and listen a little bit, but they wanted a king's ransom to use the Internet Cafe. They wanted a king's ransom for everything on the boat. And so I wasn't able to listen, but I heard Mark did a great job, and thank you very much to Mark. This is what's coming up today after we talk with Brad Mattis about the Democratic Party and the abortion issue. Peter LaBarbera will join us for the second half hour of the program. There for about 10 minutes, Peter will answer the question, was Abraham Lincoln gay? On this President's Day, we remember Abraham Lincoln and George Washington. The rumor flies around the Internet, of course, that Abraham Lincoln was homosexual. He'll clear that up, and we'll get a brief update on pro-life matters in the state of Illinois with Peter LaBarbera. To round off today's first hour, Karen Passantino, not Gretchen, but Karen Passantino, will be our guest, one of Bob and Gretchen's children. We're going to be talking to her about the new movie that's about heaven and hell, Constantine. Craig, have you seen the previews? You haven't seen the previews for Constantine. Oh, you have? You want to go see this?
Sure.
Keanu Reeves? Looks a lot like The Matrix Goes to Hell kind of a thing. Do you want to do it? All right, we'll go together. I haven't seen it, but she has. We're going to hear what she has to say about this movie, Constantine, to round off today's first hour of the program. Then, in the second hour, Suzanne Venker, you saw the cover of Time Magazine, no, Newsweek last week, The Myth of the Perfect Mother. I read the article. I was somewhat mystified. Suzanne Venker, author of the book Seven Myths of Working Mothers, will join us to give us her take on that. Then, at 4:30, Father Francis Mary of the Friary of the Eternal Word in Birmingham, Alabama, preached a sermon on the occasion of the Transfiguration on EWTN. Usually we're doing Joel Osteen, D. James Kennedy, something like that, in our weekly sermon review. We'll see what Father Francis Mary of the Friary of the Eternal Word in Birmingham, Alabama, had to say. What he didn't have to say in the course of that sermon at 4:30, and the remainder of Open Lines, Issues, Etc. will fill out the 3 hours of today's program. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Brad Mattis is our guest for the first 25 minutes. He's executive director of Life Issues Institute, based in Cincinnati, and author of an article in the Life Issues Connector newsletter titled Democratic Party Must Rethink Its Abortion Stand. Brad, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd.
Good to have you back. Before we begin on the particulars of what the Democratic Party must do, what do you think about their latest move of electing Howard Dean as the DNC chair over the likes of someone like Representative Tim Romer, who is Democrat and pro-life?
Well, Todd, I think it demonstrates that the Democrats have a very long way to go before they welcome pro-lifers into their party. It appears that unborn babies and their mothers are still kept outside the political tent.
You have written recently about Francis Kissling's kind of open letter to the pro-life community in the New York Times, and you said that it was an article, an open letter, that should be taken with a grain of salt by pro-lifers. What did Francis have to say?
Well, she questioned largely the staunchly pro-abortion stand of her movement, and she said that they've taken it on the chin politically and by polling in society. For instance, she pointed to Planned Parenthood's T-shirts they were selling announcing I had an abortion, as if they were bragging about it. She cited the abortion industry's opposition to the Lacey and Connor-Peterson bill. She said that made us seem heartless. She cited the New York Times, who said pro-abortion activists don't know how to articulate the value of unborn human life. You and I know that's because they have no value of unborn life. But she's also very much concerned about the Unborn Child Pain Awareness Act coming up that requires that an abortionist offer anesthesia to a woman's unborn baby if the child is 20 weeks or older gestation. And we learned that the partial birth abortion debate was very hard on the pro-abortion movement and turned a lot of public sentiment toward us, and they are definitely afraid of this Pain Awareness Act coming up.
Now, this is a criticism that's being leveled from within the pro-choice community. Frances Kissling, of course, is the president of Catholics for Choice. It's a pro-abortion organization. Does this signal a real change in the mindset of pro-choicers and of Democrats in particular on this issue?
Well, Todd, it might, but we have to be very careful, and that's why I say take her column with a grain of salt. Some activists in the Democrat Party are simply advocating that they repackage and rephrase how they approach the abortion issue. They're advocating they turn warm and fuzzy, but still advocate abortion on demand throughout the entire 9 months of pregnancy. And if that's the case, our people, Americans, have to be very discerning to see through that smoke and mirrors and understand it's the same old pro-abortion party and that they can't support them.
This strikes me as something that could be very subtle and could sway people's opinions, not so much about the Democrats, but about pro-choice and their rhetoric.
That's right. And one key example of that, Todd, is Hillary Clinton's recent speech where she called abortion sad and tragic. Hillary Clinton has never met an abortion she didn't like. We fully do not expect her to change her position. But what she is doing is softening her rhetoric to make her appear more mainstream and moderate on the issue.
Why has there been this total loyalty, as you call it, to the abortion industry, by and large, from the National Democratic Party?
Well, there's been a lot of political correctness on the abortion issue, and I believe that the feminists who had their heyday in decades gone by, the Democrat Party became hostage to these radical feminists and kowtowed to their demand that they support abortion on demand. They have bought into the rhetoric that the secular media has been spewing. There's been a lot of power behind the media to bolster this philosophy, and I think a lot of the Democrat incumbents and candidates have caved into that. As they gained momentum, then we saw that the leaders of the Democrat Party weeded out any candidate or incumbent who was pro-life. They simply did not get the support they needed.
To what degree is this really just a matter of political money because of the funding that is both coming from the pro-choice community and organizations and how that money is funneled and channeled within the Democratic Party?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with money. You know, politics is money makes the political world go round. But on their side, they have lots of money. On our side, we have the heart of the people who put their faith to feet and get to the polls and vote for the pro-life candidates. In the presidential election, President Bush had an 8% advantage over John Kerry on the abortion issue.
We recently did an open lines when they were still making up their mind about the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. And Tim Romer looked like he might be a viable candidate for that position. He's pro-life. He is, I believe he is Catholic, and he's also a Democrat.
Yes.
And we had call after call from Catholic listeners in the audience who said if the Democratic Party, who had been voting pro-life and therefore probably Republican or something else other than Democratic for a long time, they said if they made this move, it could signal for me a real change. I might return and start voting Democratic again. Do you think that the leadership is getting that message?
We had a glimmer of hope, as you mentioned, but I don't think that's the case now. I think things are going to have to get a lot worse than they are before they finally turn around and realize that they need to make a change. I think perhaps after the next election cycle, and if the Republicans make considerable progress, then maybe that message will sink in.
You also mentioned Kristen Day. She's a regular guest on this program, Executive Director of Democrats for Life of America. Tell us a little bit about that organization, and is it representative of a much broader group of Democrats in America?
Yes, Kristen Day is a good friend of mine also, and I'm very impressed with how she's taking this organization and bringing it into the national limelight. Democrats for Life of America are offering pro-life Democrats across the nation a way to let their voice be heard. And I would encourage any pro-life Democrat who's listening to this program to contact them and make your voice one of the many that are growing. If those numbers can increase and that voice be heard more loudly over the political rhetoric that we hear, I think that that'll really make a difference.
Some are going to say, look, Howard Dean, of course, was elected to be the chair of the Democratic National Committee. He is, on the choice issue, even being a physician as he is, as pro-choice as one can possibly be, but he's just the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. That doesn't really make a big difference. Do you agree?
No, I emphatically disagree, because I think he has a lot of power to steer financial support and organizational support to candidates. And without that, and if he diverts that to pro-abortion candidates in the primary, the pro-life candidates really don't stand much of a chance. So I see him as doing a lot of damage to the cause of pro-life Democrats in the party.
We're talking with Brad Mattis. He's executive director of Life Issues Institute based in Cincinnati about the Democratic Party and the abortion issue. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Bob is calling from his car. Bob, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. I'm interested in this question, and I'm interested in it from the standpoint of what do you really mean by pro-life or pro-choice? Are you, when you're talking about pro-life, what do you think the penalty should be? If there's no serious penalty, why are you even concerned about what public law has to say about the question of life or choice? In other words, if somebody says that the woman that has an abortion should have a $500 fine, or the physician that performs the abortion should lose his license for a year or something like that, I don't think you're really talking about pro-life. If you really think it's a human being, I would think that you should think the penalty should be the same as first-degree murder.
Bob, thank you for the call. In fact, he raises an excellent question, one that we dealt with earlier on the program. Bob, I would just recommend that you go to our website, go to the KFUO website, www.kfuo.org, and click on the Issues Etc. link that's on the left-hand side of the page. When you get there, you get to scroll down, I think, to last month, probably someplace, and there's a program there titled After Roe versus Wade, What? With Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, wherein we take up that very question on the program. Brad, what is your response to Bob's concern there?
Well, I think that we don't want to provide a simple slap on the wrist for abortionists who kill babies and maim their mothers. I think the penalty has to be swift and strong to serve as a deterrent. One thing I do not advocate, however, is punishing the women who have abortions. We see them often as victims who are in difficult situations and being lied to that they're not carrying a developed child, that they're carrying a massive tissue, a delayed pregnancy. We often see them as the victims, and we would not advocate punishing them.
What can we realistically expect over the next, say, election cycle, 2 to 4 years from the Democratic Party, given the choice of leadership that they've put in place right now?
I think that it's going to be a longer process than that. If we had seen a national party chairman who was pro-life and a few other things, I would be more hopeful. I think that as a result of what's happened since the election and since these echoes of concern have been bouncing around within the halls of Congress, I've not been very encouraged, but I am hopeful for the long term. I think there's cracks forming in the foundation of the Democrat Party, and I think that that tent may have to be widened to include unborn babies and their mothers.
Do you think that the piece of legislation you mentioned a little bit earlier in our conversation, the Unborn Child Pain Awareness Act, has a greater likelihood of passage because of less opposition from Democratic lawmakers, given their sensitivity now to this issue?
Yes, I think absolutely. One of the key things we want to look at is what happened to John Kerry. He lost in large part because he supported partial birth abortion, which is killing a baby during delivery, six times as a senator. That was a very black and white issue for Americans to digest when they went to the polls. I think a lot of people now are going to look at that and say, you know, I can't have such a radical position on abortion. So I suspect that they are telling, some pro-abortion incumbents are telling these radical pro-abortion organizations that, hey, look, I am not going to vote against giving pain medication to babies undergoing abortion.
And yet it was also then candidate John Kerry who was at least late in the election or late in the campaign calling pretty openly for a moderation of the pro-choice stance in the Democratic Party.
That's right. In November, key Democrat leaders got together in Washington, D.C. at the offices of the AFL-CIO. And the president of Emily's List, which is a pro-abortion PAC, asked Senator Kerry about his opinion of where the Democrat Party is going. And what he said made everybody in the room gasp. He said that the Democrat Party must reach out to pro-life voters, and he also said that they must welcome pro-life Democrat candidates.
When they have, and now, what was the reaction from the other pro-choice organizations to then-candidate Kerry's comments then?
Well, one of the most notable, Gloria Felt, who is the former president of Planned Parenthood, who very abruptly resigned, and we're not really sure why, her response was to criticize Kerry for not touting his pro-abortion position more strongly during the campaign, even though we know that 22% now of voters used listed moral values as the single issue that they voted for. Further polling showed that the top of that was the abortion issue.
So can we say conclusively, after the November election, that the abortion issue was a significant factor in that moral values vote that we heard so much about?
Oh, I think we absolutely can. Many political pundits have analyzed the information and digested it since the election, and I think there's pretty much a universal agreement that abortion played an important role in the presidential election and that it worked to Bush's advantage.
I'm wondering about the Republican Party, because in the next presidential election, of course, President George W. Bush will not be running. I think Cheney is very unlikely to run, and his position is a little bit less firm, I would think, than the president's in any event. The people who are polling as the most likely candidates at this point, very early, of course, are very, very soft but still pro-choice Republicans who will be running against whoever the Democrats put up. What do you think the prospects for the next presidential election look like on this issue?
Well, I think that any pro-abortion candidate like Giuliani from New York probably will not make it through the primary process, because that's where you have an environment dominated by conservative pro-life Republicans. So I think the person that's going to be the nominee will have to be pro-life. I think that the strength is there to demand that.
But is it that simple that someone could say, all right, I've listened to this conversation with Brad Madison, I came away with the notion that the Republicans have a litmus test for their candidates and for the monies that they filter there that is pro-life, the Democrats, theirs is pro-choice, and that's just the way it is. You've got your pro-life party, you got your pro-choice party.
Well, the Republicans really do have a big tent atmosphere philosophy. There are many notable pro-abortion Republicans who have received support from the Republican Party. That is simply not the case on the Democrat side of the aisle. They have weeded out and excluded candidates and incumbents who were pro-life.
I've talked to Kristen Day. I've talked to others from Democrats for Life I've talked with listeners who are Democrats and pro-life, and adamantly so. And they all hold out hope that if the Democratic Party is consistent with its core values, so to speak, it will eventually mitigate its position from pro-choice to something closer to pro-life. Do you think that's really possible?
Well, if you look at their past history, where they've been for the downtrodden and the little guy, the poor and the needy, they certainly should be pro-life, because this is the most vulnerable segment of our society, unborn children, who are being slaughtered at nearly 3,800 a day. So to follow that philosophy, that history, they should come back home and be pro-life. I know that there are millions of Democrats out there who are now voting Republican because they feel their party has abandoned them on this issue.
What has it cost the National Democratic Party in terms of politics and votes? They're standing in national offices and therefore their ability to affect legislation. What has it cost them to have this hardened loyalty toward the pro-choice community?
Well, I think it's cost them both the House and the Senate in Congress. I think it's also cost them the White House. And the evidence is pretty clear. Years ago, they had a majority of the House of Representatives, and at that time, they had 125 pro-life members. Now, they've dwindled down to being a minority with only 35 pro-life Democrats. A lot of political pundits look at the Senate and say that the Democrats lost control of the Senate when it came down to three pivotal races that were pro-life strongholds, and those were Georgia, Missouri, and Minnesota. And in each state, pro-lifers voted Republican because that's where the candidates were pro-life.
Lifeissues.org is the website for Life Issues Institute. Lifeissues.org. Brad Mattis is executive director of Life Issues Institute and author of an article in the Life Issues Connector newsletter titled Democratic Party Must Rethink Its Abortion Stand. Brad, thanks for being our guest again.
You bet. Thank you, Todd.
When we come back from this break, the second 25 minutes of Issues Etc., Peter LaBarbera will be our guest for the first part of that. Was Abraham Lincoln gay? I saw this when I got back from vacation in my email. Several of them had been forwarded to me by listeners. Some were just, you know, looky here again at what's circulating throughout the internet. Others were a little more mystified. We'll get that question answered right away with Peter LaBarbera, executive director of Illinois Family Institute based in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. And we'll talk a bit about Illinois pro-life issues as well with Peter. And then we'll round off the first hour today. Karen Passantino, Bob and Gretchen's daughter, one of them, will talk to us about the new movie about heaven and hell, Constantine. This is a movie that when I saw the previews for it recently in the theater, I said, I gotta go see it. Well, two reasons. One, it had the star of The Matrix in it, and it's hard for me, a Matrix fan, not to go see this movie. It also was dealing with, really, the cosmic issue that faces every human being, heaven and hell. No, I don't think Keanu Reeves is cute. I think he's cool. And there's a big difference between thinking he's cute and thinking he's cool. And I reserve that word, by the way, Jeff, for very few people, and not you. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Joshua is one of the towering figures of the Old Testament, a successor to the prophet Moses, the first of the judges. He leads God's people into and through the promised land. But as great as Joshua is in the Old Testament, does he serve to prefigure someone even greater? Is there a connection between Joshua in the Old Testament and our Savior Jesus Christ in the New? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Joshua, is a Christ-centered and cross-focused reading of this Old Testament book. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find information there on the Concordia Commentary on Joshua, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February. Or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040.
Early in the morning and during the day, millions of Muslims are faithful to pray. This global minute invites you to ask God to cause them to realize they're praying to a God who can't hear them. Islam teaches prayer as a gift given to every Muslim, and and praying five times a day is not supposed to be a burden, but rather a chance to experience a spiritual ascension on a regular basis. Prayers are led by a man called an imam who learned the Quran. Muslims have five prescribed prayers containing verses from the Quran, and they're required to say them in Arabic. They believe Arabic is the language of divine intervention, but personal prayers are allowed to be said in any language. Pray Muslims will come to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ and learn of Christ's teaching on prayer as part of an intimate and loving relationship with our Heavenly Father. Learn more about the beliefs of Muslims and ways you can pray for them with a visit to the website missionvisionnetwork.org. missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute, and a happy President's Day sale to you. Huh? You say this isn't President's Day sale, but just President's Day? I think you are wrong. Look through today's newspaper. President's Day sale ads all over the place. Why did Washington and Lincoln endure all they did? Wasn't it so we can have our malls and catalogs and internet shopping? And isn't America about buying ourselves stuff? Some of you just don't get it. Church people, for example. Congregations often struggle to make their budgets. So I suggest they sell naming rights to their churches. St. Matthew could become AOL Church. Trinity Church could become Ford Motors Church, and so on. Companies would pay big bucks to have their logo on the front of the church and maybe even on the minister's robe. I think that's a swell idea. But church people just stare at me in disbelief. They keep quoting some Bible passages like 1 Timothy 6, "Godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that." I don't know. Contentment with godliness? It just doesn't seem to fit the spirit of modern America. Happy President's Day!
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois. Christ Our Savior is located at 612 North State Street in Freeburg. The Reverend Bruce Kaseman is the pastor. Their phone number, area code 618-539-5664. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, and Issues Etc. underwriter on AM 850 KFUO. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Back with you live. It is the 21st, Monday, the 21st of February. Was Abraham Lincoln gay? You know, the stovetop hat and the suits and the... He didn't look gay, at least in the pictures. And no one has ever raised this issue, as far as I know, to this point about our former president, but... It's being raised nowadays. Peter LaBarbera joins us for about the next 10 minutes. Executive Director of Illinois Family Institute, based in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, to answer that question and to give us a brief update on life issues in the state of Illinois. Peter, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. What was your reaction, Peter, to the news that Abraham Lincoln, whom I'm an Illinoisan as well, we take great pride in that in our president, that he was possibly homosexual?
Well, you know, I think it's a bunch of baloney, Todd, and the sad thing is that the homosexual activists are making these charges, and poor Abe Lincoln is not there to defend himself. And this is all very scurrilous research, Todd, and it's astonishing that Simon & Schuster, I think, would publish such a book.
So tell us about the book and the nature of the accusations that are being made about Abraham Lincoln.
Yes, the book is called, and I hate to give it publicity here, but it's called The Intimate World of Abraham Lincoln. It's published by a now-deceased homosexual named C.A. Tripp. And here's the kind of evidence he cited. Lincoln had a friend named Joshua Speed, and in his earlier days, when he didn't have a lot of money, they were bunkmates. They would sleep in the same bed, as many people did, many men did, because there weren't as many beds back then. It was poorer time. And this supposed scholar is now saying, well, that's evidence that Lincoln was had a homosexual affair with this Joshua Speed. I mean, that's the kind of stuff we're talking about here, Todd.
So the fact that Lincoln shared a bunk
with a guy, he's saying, that he was gay. Now, here's another one, Todd. Tripp, this gay writer, who's now deceased, says that Lincoln, he would use the words "yours forever" in signing his letter to Joshua Speed. Now, it turns out he said "yours forever" to a lot of different men, and it was like saying cordially "yours," and he was using that as evidence of that he was supposedly gay. And I just think this is very spurious research.
And you say that this book has been published by Simon & Schuster?
Yes, it's published by Simon & Schuster, and it has been given serious treatment within some media circles. And it's very, and of course now the homosexual activists, they're saying, oh, it's you know, for certain now, Abe Lincoln was gay. And I just think that really is not fair to a man who can't, who's not alive to defend himself. And we must remember, Abe Lincoln revered the Bible. I think it's preposterous to suggest that he was involved in homosexual immorality.
What do more reputable Lincoln scholars and scholars of that era, what has their reaction been to this suggestion?
Well, I read some of the scholars. One is David Herbert Donald. He's one of the most famous biographers of Lincoln, Todd. David Herbert Donald said that this is ridiculous to say that because he was friends with Joshua Speed that he was a homosexual. Another man named Michael Burlingame said that this book by Dr. Tripp does a, quote, disservice to history, and he says that he doesn't provide the evidence. Again, what's happening here, Todd, is that homosexuals who maybe have a misunderstanding of what true male bonding is are sexualizing it. It's sort of like the thief who thinks everybody steals, and I think it's very sad.
Well, why is that? Why does the homosexual activist community or individuals feel the need to reach back into history and make allegations about men like Abraham Lincoln about their sexuality?
Well, I think it's an attempt to validate their sexual identity. And if they can say that such and such famous characters, Abraham Lincoln, of course, they reach back to the Bible. They say that David and Jonathan in the Old Testament were, quote, gay. And really, it was just a close male friendship, a loving, agape love male friendship. And, you know, to say that that's homosexual is just a misunderstanding of human nature. But they're trying to validate their sexual identity so that they can get rid of the guilt, which I believe is in every man. Every man has a conscience. They're trying to get rid of the guilt that I think God gave them, which would say that this is a wrong behavior, a wrong lifestyle.
Now, things that circulate in books tend to make the press. That kind of gets a buzz going around the water cooler. It circulates on the internet as well. I got a bunch of emails about this over the time I was on vacation, and when I returned, there they were all. And I didn't take any of them that seriously. But this, the longer something like this tends to be in the atmosphere, the more people give it plausibility. Is that your biggest concern?
Yes, and that's a great observation, Todd. You know, I know that there was a nutty professor, and I can't remember his name, Shively his name was. He wrote a terribly vulgar book. Since I monitor the homosexual movement, I saw this this accusation several years ago. But I never thought it would get to the point where it would be taken seriously by even National Review magazine had an essay which didn't just ridicule this. It almost entertained it as a serious possibility. And I think that that is the danger, Todd, is that these things are spread around. And before you know it, we're going to have our kids being taught in public schools that Abraham Lincoln was our first gay president. I mean, we cannot underestimate the level of that, what political correctness will do to our general understanding of facts.
I'm concerned about the definition of virtue here because, it, for good or for ill, as a man and as a president, Abraham Lincoln stands as kind of all the presidents, of all the presidents that we've had, the paragon of virtue. He is the one that is, because of the nature of his conflict he served with and because of the nature of his sudden death, he has been given kind of iconic status. He is the picture of American virtue for most Americans who know any history whatsoever.
Yeah.
And if the possibility can be entertained publicly or eventually make it into textbooks, well, maybe he was gay. It seems to be close to making a vice into a virtue.
Yes, and great observation, Todd, and that's why they want to get him, because he is so virtuous. And, you know, I just think this is a political tactic. It's an intimidation thing, and they know that the media could care less about homosexuality. Most journalists do not share our opposition. They almost take a sort of a amoral view. It's not an immoral view, an amoral view of these things. And so they make their points through the media, but I think the average person sees through it. But what worries me is that this becomes the topic of conversation, like you said. And here's a man who is such a model for our young people and for America in general. And to drag him through the mud when he can't defend himself and show use all these this ridiculous thing, like he signs his letters to other men saying "forever yours," these ridiculous examples, to give that serious treatment, I think degrades, it sort of corrupts our whole societal conversation.
So let's bring this into the 21st century, still in the land of Lincoln. Tell us about gay rights legislation in the state of Illinois.
Yes, we just had a terrible bill, Senate Bill 3186, signed into law by Governor Blagojevich. This is a bill that grants rights based on homosexual and transsexual behavior. And Todd, we are already calling for a repeal of this legislation. We're asking legislators to get on board for opposing this because we think the way it was done and how dangerous it is, even affecting people's right to act on their own moral beliefs, we think it should be thrown out.
And what are the chances of such a repeal?
Well, the chances that right now, with Blagojevich able to veto it, are almost nil. But we think we need to put a stake in the ground and say we want to repeal this. We might not get it this year, but we're going to be pushing for it every year.
And since we have you, what about the status of pro-life issues in the state of Illinois?
Well, we have a very good chance for the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, which is an important bill which says that a fetus, when born, cannot be killed. Because what was happening, Todd, as you know, is babies were born through live botched abortions. They were born alive, and then they were just allowed to die after the attempted abortion. And it was terribly gruesome, but they would let them starve to death. And we are working for legislation that would make that illegal, that you would have to treat those babies like the human beings that they are, not just let them die.
Here's the website for the Illinois Family Institute, illinoisfamily.org, illinoisfamily.org. Peter LaBarbera is Executive Director of Illinois Family Institute, based in Glen Ellen, Illinois. Peter, thanks again for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd. God bless.
Our Issues Etc. Reformation Club is... we've had this around for about a year and a half now, and we're very happy with the degree to which our listeners have caught on to what this is really all about. It's about ongoing support for a truth-centered broadcast like Issues Etc. Help us contend for truth in an age of anti-truth, where you stay informed on social issues in the 21st century, like pro-life legislation and pro-homosexual legislation, and what it means for you in your state and nationally. That's part of what we're doing here on Issues Etc. That's why we call ourselves Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian. Our Issues Etc. Reformation Club is a monthly donor program. Our goal is 125 members by Easter of this year. We're over 100 now, and we ended 2004 with over 100. We're headed toward 125. If you want more information on the Issues Etc. Reformation Club, how to become a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You can join by check. Just write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. You can join by credit card. 1-800-737-0172 is our resource line number. 1-800-737-0172. It's the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be talking about a movie I'm anxious to see. Keanu Reeves is the star. The subject is heaven and hell. Karen Passantino, daughter of Bob and Gretchen Passantino of Answers in Action, joins us for the remainder of this first hour of Issues Etc. Karen, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi there.
Karen, what's it like to be the daughter of Bob and Gretchen Passantino?
Very interesting, to say the least. I grew up, you know, meeting and knowing really famous people and really average people, and so I got an expanse of just anybody and everybody in between.
This is what I picture, Karen. I picture the Passantino house, and it's full of books on the walls, and here's Karen toddling around over piles of books while mother and father sit there debating matters of the cults and theology. Is that a pretty accurate picture of your childhood in the Passantino house?
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty accurate. When I got older, I'd start debating with them, and I'd start reading the books with them. But, you know, when I was toddler, I was pretty much stumbling over the books. Yeah.
So what was dinner conversation like?
Oh, it'd go on for about 4 hours on any topic anywhere. You know, you could have a topic on theology. You could have a topic on the latest movie, for example. You know, basically anything that somebody would bring up, we'd get into long discussions, just in the ins and outs and the different viewpoints and different sides to it.
Okay, one last question on the Pasentino family. Who did the most talking?
My dad.
In the dinner conversation?
My dad, definitely.
Has mom taken up since your father passed away doing most of the talking now?
Oh, no, I think us kids, you know, we hold our own. So.
Okay. Well, how was your dad able to get so many words packed into so little time? I mean, I interviewed him many times, and I've never known a guy who could say so many, have such a long sentence in such a short amount of time.
It's a technique that I believe is probably inherited from the Sicilian side of the family. And it's just an ability that, like, I have, all three of us kids pretty much inherited it, and I think I inherited the worst, and I really have to, you know, slow down my speaking and concentrate and go, okay, I cannot talk that fast to these people because they will not understand what I'm saying. So, I mean, it's almost like a separate language where you just are able to just combine the words and shorten them and just be able to say a really long thing in a really short amount of time.
And how old are you, Karen?
I'm 24.
Okay. Okay. All right. So I'm going to ask you, for my sake, to speak slowly as we talk about Constantine, this movie about heaven and hell starring Keanu Reeves. What is the movie all about, really?
The movie is about Constantine. Actually, it's based on a comic book series. I've never read the comic series. I don't really know very much about it. But Constantine tried to commit suicide when he was a teenager, I believe, and they revived him after he was dead for 2 minutes or something. And based on the Catholic beliefs, which I'm not, you know, necessarily supporting or denying, if you try to commit suicide, then you're automatically damned to hell. So Constantine, though, is now damned to hell, but he's still alive. So he decides to try to get back into heaven. And so what he does is he destroys all the demons that are on earth, going after them and killing them so he can win his way back into heaven. Basically, he doesn't understand that he's going to fail at that because God doesn't want you in heaven because you want to be in heaven, and he's doing it for himself. He's not doing it for other people. He's killing these demons not to protect other people but to get him into heaven. And so he's not going to make it into heaven because he's not following the right path, basically. So then what happens is there's another suicide person, and her sister comes to Constantine asking for help, saying that she doesn't believe her twin sister committed suicide. And so Constantine and I believe her name's Angela, they go investigating to find out what happened to Angela's twin sister, and did she really commit suicide, and is she really going to hell, and that sort of thing.
And since he's battling and doing jousting with the demons, on what basis does he do warfare with the demon realm?
What it is at the very beginning of the movie, it starts with an exorcist, where Constantine's called to help a girl who's being possessed. And he tries to get this demon out of the girl, and then he finds out that the demon's actually trying to get out of the girl, but not, but in order to become physical in the human realm, which demons supposedly, according to the universe of Constantine, are not able to do. They're only able to possess the people. But this demon actually wants to come to Earth and be able to roam around the Earth. So when Constantine discovers that, he realizes there's some sort of upheaval going on in the demon world, and he sets off to find out, you know, what he can do to stop the demons from actually, you know, breaking forth and invading the world.
Tell us about the Christian symbolism in the movie Constantine.
It seems to be based mostly in Catholic beliefs. There's a spear involved, which I'm not sure what the name of it is off the top of my head. But it has to do with that Jesus really didn't die on the cross from his wounds, but he died from the spear being thrust up into his heart. And that spear is this symbol of power, and whoever has it rules the world. And it was lost in World War II, I believe, and that's the last time they saw it. And then that spear, you know, is found again. in present day, and that's one of the reasons why they believe that this, you know, the end of the world's coming and everything is because the spear is turned up again. There's the whole entire belief on, you know, if you commit suicide, you're going straight to hell. There's a whole heaven and hell, you know, the fight between heaven and hell. What they actually state in the movie is basically heaven, the angels and God stay in heaven, and the demons and the devil stay in hell. And then on earth, everybody, all the humans are allowed free will. They're not allowed to be intervened by the angels or the demons. But the angels and the demons can tempt them to do right or wrong. So because of that influence, that's why you end up having people who do bad things and, you know, that sort of thing. But it still lends credence to the free will aspect. So that at least I appreciated. That didn't say that nobody has any choice. They're just doomed either way.
What in the movie would blatantly contradict the Christian worldview and a biblical worldview?
I don't think there's anything blatant. I think there's a lot of, it's a very different and very interesting aspect. There's probably a couple of things that are, you know, you'd probably want to research a little bit better. There's nothing I saw outright that I said, oh my gosh, I cannot believe they did that. That's just so, you know, sacrilegious, whatever you want to call it, blasphemous. There's nothing that I was totally offended by. But there's a couple of things that are like, I don't really think, I think they kind of stretched it to make it fit so the movie would, you know, flow properly. I don't really think that's gospel, but, you know, at least it makes the movie flow better. You know, there's a couple aspects like that, but there wasn't anything that was just outright in your face wrong.
does the cross, does Jesus Christ play any role in the whole conflict that's in the movie, in the resolution of that conflict, in the movie itself?
Sorry, I missed that first part of that.
Does Jesus Christ and his work at the cross to save sinners from their damnation, does that play any role in this movie whatsoever?
Not really. The only mention of Jesus is that spear that I mentioned earlier. That's basically the only time they bring up Jesus and, you know, his salvation and anything like that. The other aspect, though, is that the whole way the world's going to end is that Jesus was born to save the humans and send them to heaven. Now it's time for the devil's son to be born. And that, I guess you can say, is pretty theologically, you know, incorrect. And they also have extra Bible verses in the Bible from hell. They have this Bible from hell that has extra Bible verses, and it speaks about how the devil's son's going to be born, and that's going to constitute the end of the world, which is, it's creative license. It's not anything really absolutely, you know, just absolutely wrong that would offend anybody. It's just they're trying to create a story, and in order to create the story, they have to have a balance. You know, and I can understand that from that point of view, but, I mean, I would think that if anybody actually believed that and said, oh, you know, so the devil is going to have a child and that's going to mean the end of the world, then they need to read up a little bit better, you know, on their Bibles. But that's pretty much the only time they mentioned Jesus. It's just the dichotomy between Jesus' birth and the devil's son's alleged birth that's going to happen to create the end of the world.
Does the movie Constantine promote the kind of the typical milquetoast Hollywood version of both heaven and hell?
Yes and no. I mean, it's great visuals, and even though it is, you know, they don't ever show heaven, they do show the angel Gabriel, and I thought the actress who represented the angel did an incredible job, and that's pretty much the only aspect you get of heaven. They do show the devil. They do show what hell looks like, and hell is basically, it's pretty much like the world is just destroyed. It looks almost like, you know, after an atomic bomb has hit and everything's wiped out. That's the portrayal of hell, and it's a really, really, you know, powerful visual that they give, and I really appreciated that and the work they did for that. But there's not, you know, there's nothing really heaven that's shown. I mean, they do show a couple of clips of, like, the Virgin Mary and, you know, some, you know, weapons and stuff like that, and crosses, but there's nothing that, it's a really dark movie, so I think if they had put a heaven visual in there, it'd make the movie too light.
So. Contrast this and compare this, if you would, with Keanu Reeves' series of movies on The Matrix.
Oh, it's way better than the second two. I did not like the second two very much, but it's either better than the first Matrix or a close second to the first Matrix. I'd probably have to see this movie again to be able to determine where it falls. But It's the cinematography, the lighting, the directing, like everything is very similar to the first Matrix. The only thing the first Matrix has that this does not is that it's much more thought-provoking. The first Matrix is much more thought-provoking and really makes you, you know, there are quotes and lines from the first Matrix that makes that you reflect on after you've seen it and just go, wow, that's such an interesting perspective. And this one doesn't really have too much of that. It's a little lighter in that aspect. But it's still just great visuals, great effects. Everything that was done, you know, the whole entire ambiance of the movie, you come away from thinking, wow, that was just like The Matrix. And you really don't want to say that because, you know, it's not, then that makes it not better than the first Matrix, you know, but it is something to be aware of when you go and see it.
So, Karen, finally, if you took your unbelieving friend with you to see Constantine, mm-hmm. What would you say? Okay, I got to clear up a few things. What would those few things be? With only about a minute here,
I would have to. I don't think there would be really anything to clear up because I did take my unbelieving friend actually to be truthful, and she thought of it as a great action movie. She didn't think of it at all religious wise. She didn't come away going, so that's what heaven and hell is like. So that's what's really going. She didn't care like. To her, it was a great action movie. She didn't care about the religious aspects of it, and she just thought it was interesting, and she thought it was fun, and she thought it was just fantastic, and she loved, you know, the acting. Keanu Reeves, I must say, has managed to do a pretty good job in this movie, but it's the same exact role he plays in most every other movie he's in. But he does a good job still. And she, you know, she loved the acting in it. She loved everything about it. But she didn't really have an opinion about the religious, you know, she thought of it as just a plot. She didn't think of it as this is biblical. You know, this is what Christians believe. She didn't even come away with it, like, thinking that.
So with only a few seconds, give it a star rating. Out of 4 stars, how many stars would you give it, Karen?
I'd probably give it about 3, maybe 3.5.
All right. I think she's in line there with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in her rating there. Karen Pasentino, daughter of Bob and Gretchen Pasentino of Answers in Action. Thank you for being our guest.
Thank you.
All right, we've come to the end of the first hour, headed into the second hour. We're going to be talking with Suzanne Venker. You saw Newsweek magazine, the cover story last week. I saw it as well, Myth of the Perfect Mother. We're going to be talking about that article and motherhood with Suzanne Venker, former middle school English teacher, mother of 2 children here in St. Louis, and author of the book, 7 Myths of Working Mothers. When we come back from this break, that'll be a half hour's conversation. Then we'll start some open lines. Begin it by listening to a sermon, a homily on the Transfiguration, at least it's supposed to be about the Transfiguration, from Father Francis May of the Friary of the Eternal Word in Birmingham, Alabama. A little bit of a sermon review in about 25 minutes. Suzanne Venker is next. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.